This is the Quote the Raven podcast. Today's February 28th, 2018. So, anything interesting going on today, guys? Anything? No? Should we just call it a day, wrap it up, and shut up? Oh, there was a couple of things that happened today. There were one or two small things. And actually, there were a couple of things that happened yesterday, too, that are worth mentioning. So I was thinking I would go in chronological order and talk first about Jerome Powell in Congress yesterday and talk a little bit about how I ate it on Fitbit earnings and then also how I continued to eat it today as shares of Herbalife hit $95 a share during the middle of the session today, which is it's certainly a spectacle and it's definitely going to be worth talking about for a second. As you may notice, I still don't have any introduction music and I still don't have a disclaimer recorded, so I'm not going to try and do introduction music on my own, but what I will tell you as a disclaimer is I am consistently wrong. I am not a registered investment advisor. I hold no licenses. Nothing I say is investment advice. Everything is opinion only. And basically, as I always say, I was serving beer for a living 8 years ago. So just take that all into account, okay? You're not listening to Charlie Munger. This is not the Warren Buffett podcast. This is not the Bill Gates podcast. This is, I'm sitting around in my house like George Costanza in sweatpants with potato chip crumbs on my shirt, just looking like a complete and total disaster. So, and you'll be happy to know that in my new disclaimer I have coming, aside from all of the general things that you need to know that basically sum up to don't listen to me because I have no idea what's going on, I'm also going to indicate to listeners that I would prefer a 2-drink minimum before listening to this podcast. Not so that you guys think that I'm funnier or more amusing, but it would just put me at a great sense of ease to know that the people listening to me are a little inebriated, so I feel a little less pressure to actually make sense, and that would help me out a lot. So help me help you, and rip a couple of shots before you listen to this podcast next time and just see, you know what, maybe what you do is you listen today, right? You go all the way through and then you go rip a couple of shots and you come back and you listen again. And that would be like the preferred method since I think in terms of royalties, I make one one-hundred-thousandth of a cent every time somebody listens. So if you could do that twice, in terms of my income, that would make a profound difference. It's actually like, you know, those coupons that used to say cash value one one-millionth of a cent. You know, you would have like a coupon for 40 cents from Campbell's Soup. I was used to think if you could get 15 trillion of those, and you had the resources to put them all together and then just return to the Campbell's Soup Corporation with like a locomotive full of coupons, and you had a trillion of them, and they were like all valued at one one-millionth of a cent or something, you could just deliver them and then demand your $100 or $10 or $1,000 or whatever it is, which is, you know, an idea that I got when they were doing the bottle deposit on Seinfeld, trying to figure out how, no, of course that wasn't an actual idea I had. All right, look, it was an idea I considered very quickly when I was much younger, but it didn't pan out, and it's not a fixed income strategy that I would recommend. Having said all of that, there is a little bit that we got to talk about. Jerome Powell was at Congress yesterday, and Congress did what they usually do, which is grandstand, bring up a bunch of issues that have no relation whatsoever to the Fed, you know, talking about social issues, talking about things that don't have anything to do with monetary policy. I guess you could argue that these things are affected by monetary policy, and that's why they bring them up. But without making a partisan political statement, what I will say is so many of these congresspeople are so full of shit. They know that they're getting television time. They want to go out and take whatever the event is, whether it's a subcommittee hearing, whether they're putting in their lunch order from Chick-fil-A for, you know, that day. If it's on C-SPAN or it's on CNBC, they're going to try and turn it into some, you know, political event and pander to whoever it is that they're trying to pander to. And both sides of the aisle are guilty of this. And so we got a lot of that yesterday, you know, with this. What the Congress should have been asking Jerome Powell is, you know, what the fuck is going on? We have equity markets that are through the roof. We have massive inflation in asset prices over the last 10 years, all different types of financial assets. We have the Fed's balance sheet now double what it was 10 years ago, or probably more than double what it was 10 years ago. We have a previous Fed chair, and I love this, by the way. I love this. Yellen comes out yesterday, right, and makes this statement like, yeah, you know, now that you mention it, things look expensive. It's like, what? Where were you? Where were you like 3 weeks ago? You know, 3 weeks ago, everything was fine. But now all of a sudden, things look expensive. Do you think it could have something to do with the fact that she's no longer the Fed chair? Probably. It's just incredulous at this point. It's incredulous. Yellen has presided over the markets where we have, you know, the policy has been deficit spending. Valuations have gone through the roof. All types of debt are now off the charts at 2008 levels or above 2008 levels. Mortgage debt, consumer credit debt, automobile debt, these, you know, all this types of new, like toxic kind of lenders like Lending Club, you know, and all of these like toxic financiers. There's a lot of debt there. There's a lot of debt with student loans. And everything's fine when Janet is presiding over everything, right? She sits in front of Congress and she says, look, you know, things are, things may be a little frothy, but they're not crazy. Things aren't crazy. And then boom, Jerome Powell steps in and Yellen's first comment is, well, things actually do look expensive now that you mention it. And by the way, Jerome, enjoy your tenure as Fed chair. I mean, I said once before, Yellen has made like the great escape, right? She's going to have, you know, a quote unquote legacy, at least in her own mind and in the minds of people like Paul Krugman, of being this brilliant. Anybody can go in and print money to buy bonds. I mean, there's like a Ben Shapiro quote that was like, you know, to be this stupid, you have to be highly educated or something to that effect. Or you have to be highly educated to be this stupid or something like that. You know, anybody can do that. The question is, can we unwind the stimulus that we have injected into the market, right? And these are some of the things that Powell touched on yesterday. You know, they tossed around the principle of whether or not the Fed was going to start to offload some of the bonds on its balance sheet. I mean, they can't. They don't have an option, right? The 10-year yield is going to be above 3% soon. The cost of capital for everybody is going to go up. And that's really without a seller. It's certainly without the Fed as a seller. You have legitimate sellers in the market now. You probably have foreign money that's selling bonds. You probably have retail that's selling bonds here. You know, what's going to happen when the Fed hits the bid? I mean, this isn't like, you know, a family office full of bond traders that have $10 million worth of exposure. All right, we're talking fucking trillions with a T. Trillions. So what the hell is going to happen when the Fed tries to come in and sell their bonds? It can't happen. It's not going to happen, which is why I tweeted yesterday. You know, I find the whole thing hilarious. If you listen to my first podcast with Bill Fleckenstein, it says the same exact thing. You know, the Fed doesn't have the option. They can't come in and start selling bonds because the entire economy will crash, right? So Yellen leaves and, of course, will now go on her speaking tour where she is paid probably by various financial institutions and other, you know, pieces of the Illuminati make, and I say that only half jokingly, just so you know. I mean, I'm not full on Alex Jones, but at the end of the day, we have to understand that these financial institutions kind of do fucking run the world, and they're all in bed with the Federal Reserve. So you look at something like, Yellen's tenure, and she, like I'm saying, she'll go on a book tour now, and she'll make herself many millions of dollars, and then who knows what she'll do. She'll become a lobbyist or whatever. But her tenure as Fed chair is going to be considered a success because the stock market went up and because we didn't have a crisis on her watch. Now, Brother Powell is going to have a little bit trickier of a time because he is inheriting a stock market that is on the ass end of a 10-year run. He's inheriting a situation where Yellen has basically said, we're going to unwind. And by the way, Jerome, you're up. So good luck with that. I mean, what a shit position to be in, right? I mean, I guess you have to say yes. Somebody asks if you want to be the Fed chair because you're essentially the Emperor Palpatine of the U.S. economy at that point. And basically of the world. I mean, it's almost like being the president. I mean, it's an extraordinarily powerful position. So I guess you have to say yes. But I wouldn't have said yes if they had asked me to. I know I make jokes on my Twitter, you know, make me Fed chair. I can be on the FOMC. Anybody can do it. I stand by the fact that anybody can do it. But I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it. Because what are you going to do? How are you going to unwind the stimulus that you've put into the market? You have two options. You can keep pushing with the stimulus. You can keep printing money. You can keep making sure that asset prices stay inflated. You can keep making sure that the stock market continues to go up. And you can keep making sure that, you know, the purchasing power of the dollar continues to decline and that inflation stays steady the way that it's measured by the Fed. But at the end of the day, something is going to give eventually. So Greenspan took this policy and he handed it to Bernanke. And Bernanke took this pile of shit and he handed it to Yellen. And, you know, we went through 2008. Yellen has now taken this giant pile of shit, which is more debt. The economy is more bloated now. Asset prices are much higher than they've ever been. The stock market valuations are immense. The Shiller PE ratio is like over 30. And Yellen has taken this package and basically come out and said, look, we're going to start to unwind this. And by the way, have you met my friend Jerome? If you need me, I will be backing quietly out of the door. At which point, all you see is Jerome Powell standing there with a piss stain on his pants. You hear the door slam and all of a sudden you hear the sound of tires screeching as Janet Yellen peels ass out of the parking lot in her fucking brand new Porsche. So now Jerome Powell's sitting in front of Congress yesterday. And aside from dealing with all of the grandstanding that our idiot politicians have done, I just love that. You know, it's supposed to be a hearing about monetary policy, and you can just tell that these elected officials try to twist that discussion into some type of pretzel about some obscure, you know, bullshit controversy in their local jurisdiction. You know, it's like, yeah, well, We noticed that inflation is getting close to meeting your targets, but what is that going to do for the people of Paducah, Idaho, who are experiencing a rapid growth of, you know, donut shops on our local highway, and it's just it's becoming very overbearing in the commercial zones, and the residents feel crowded, and it's creating a lot of traffic. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about? What are you talking about? We're here to talk about the state of the global economy, which is a disaster, according to me, the guy in sweatpants with potato chip crumbs on his shirt. And every politician that spoke yesterday had to twist their questions to Powell about these stupid issues that have nothing to do with the economy. It's like, this is, I'll try to keep this show nonpartisan, so I don't really give a shit how you feel about all of these political issues. But whether you're on the left or whether you're on the right or whether you're in the middle, you have to realize if you watch this congressional hearing, this is just elected officials trying to grandstand, you know. And you get somebody up there that knows nothing about finance and nothing about economics, and they try to ask questions that, you know, have no relevance to the new Fed chair. What they should be asking is, what are we going to do when we have no choice but to raise rates and we can't pay the coupon on our debt? There's a fucking great question, right? Somebody put that on Twitter too yesterday. Somebody should be asking Jerome Powell what we're going to do when, you know, interest rates have to go up. Why would you ask that when you can, you know, ask somebody about some local bridge that's been closed back on Country Road 572 and, you know, some ornery taxpayer that shows up to a town council meeting every week complains about there's not enough stop signs. This is not what we should be talking about. But I digress. I guess it is in the nature of politicians to do that stuff, and I will just continue to barf up my lunch when I see that, and we'll move forward amicably, I guess. The point is, nothing that Jerome Powell said yesterday, and somebody asked this on Quora too, you know, how's Jerome Powell going to be different from Janet Yellen? The answer is they're not going to be different. I mean, there may be small differences. They may speak differently. They may, you know, there may be a 25 basis point difference in terms of hawkishness and dovishness between the two of them. But they all fall into the same bucket. And that bucket is individuals that think that economic stimulus and printing money is the end-all, be-all solution and the way to create prosperity. And it's just not the case. The problem is the floor hasn't given out yet. And we won't know when it's going to happen. And we don't know how it's going to happen. But if we continue down this road, it's going to happen. And if they don't step back from, you know, as Fleckenstein said on my first podcast, you know, their economic models and their PhDs and all this stuff, if they don't step back from that and just take a common sense look at the state of the economy and the way that they're running it, we're not going to get anywhere. So what we need is we need a hawkish Fed chair, a real hawkish Fed chair. We need a Volcker, right? We need somebody that's going to come in and who has a different perspective, but that, you know, that would scare the shit out of politicians and it would make it, you know, spending would stop and all of these pork-laden spending bills that get passed wouldn't happen and the money would dry up and it creates some discomfort. It creates discomfort for politicians. It creates discomfort for their, you know, constituencies and the people that they represent. So nobody likes that. Nobody likes taking the medicine, as Peter Schiff says, right? Nobody likes bucking up. You know, I read on Twitter, somebody put a couple days ago, a couple weeks ago, if we had done what we needed to do in 2008 and let some banks fail and let the economy take its medicine and we had some real austerity and we had some discomfort, we would probably be starting an actual legitimate recovery right now. But instead, we have a bigger bubble and a bigger problem. And Jerome Powell just doesn't seem like he's going to be the visionary to make it happen. So I'm making a prediction now. The Fed does not unwind its balance sheet. In fact, its balance sheet gets bigger. You know, he made a bunch of these nebulous statements that like, well, we're gonna unwind the balance sheet and we're going to try and undo all this economic stimulus, but maybe we won't. You know, that was basically, they leave all these open-ended, we have to see how things go. It's like, listen, we know what you're going to do. You know what you're going to do. You can't help it. You can't help it. When everybody's asleep late at night and you're laying in bed and you're thinking like, yeah, I'm going to be different. I'm going to be the guy that unwinds the balance sheet and I'm going to prove that this whole Keynesian pile of crap is going to work. Everybody goes to sleep and it's 3 o'clock in the morning and there's not a sound anywhere in Washington. You creep out of bed. You go down to the kitchen, you get yourself an ice cream sandwich, and then you walk with your pajamas down the hall to that big, beautiful printing press, and you fire that motherfucker up like an old kerosene engine. And you think, well, maybe today's the day we have to create the $1 trillion bill, because we can't print 20s fast enough, or we can't print hundreds fast enough. I'm cracking myself up, but this is really what happens. So, anyways, for my this concludes the macroeconomic portion of this show. This will be a steady theme throughout the course of this podcast. I think everything is horrible. So that's my analysis for today. What do you guys think about that? Hashtag equity analysis. Everything's terrible. Don't buy anything except gold. If you asked for my advice, that would be my advice. And again, commodities, gold, why do they look so sexy if you're of the crazy Dr. Doom mind view that I am? They look sexy because there's a finite amount of them, at least until the huge trillion-dollar asteroid, you know, crashes into Earth, or Goldman Sachs throws a fishing line up there to get it and reel it back down to Earth because they want that $1 trillion so badly they can't fucking help it. They dream about it. But until that happens, you know, we only have so much gold, we only have so much silver, we only have so much of these natural resources that are commodities. So, you know, Monsanto can't go and genetically engineer gold, and that's why I like it. I don't want anybody to touch the supply part of the equation. And if things start to get a little crazy, and that's why, because gold is priced in dollars, why gold has gone from $35 an ounce in the 70s to $1,300 an ounce where it is now. And I predict that it will continue to go up. So that's my macro analysis. By the way, it's going to be the same for as long as Fed policy stays the same. So if you want to save yourself listening to 1,500 additional episodes of this podcast, just replay this last 20 minutes every time you want, and there you go. And that, unfortunately, will cost me 1/1,000,000th of a cent, but it's going to be what it's going to be. Now, let's just talk about Herbalife real quick, okay? A couple of things went down today. They announced they were doing a 2-for-1 split this morning. They added to their Dutch tender, so they're going to go out and tender for, I think, $750 million worth of more shares. They're making a monumental name change from Herbalife to Herbalife. And I wanted to just go over a couple of my thoughts on these things. I wrote a Seeking Alpha article very early this morning about the Dutch tender and what kind of was the first thing that popped into my mind about that. And that was, can Carl Icahn sell into it? So I don't know if you remember, but the Dutch tender auction that took place in the summer of 2017, the company put right in the press release that Carl Icahn did not intend on tendering his shares. And there was no such verbiage in this morning's press release. So I just found that very interesting. It wasn't like I was reading some, you know, deep down exhibit on an SEC filing. They put it right in the PR, and it was not in the PR this morning. So that was the first kind of thing that I noticed. And Ivan the K on Twitter, I think, noticed also too, because as soon as I asked about it, he also said that he was wondering the same thing. So that immediately makes me think about what Carl Icahn is going to do. What is he going to do? I mean, I'd encourage you to take a look at my Seeking Alpha article that I wrote today, but if you haven't seen it, you're going to basically get the contents right now. Icahn is going to have to either buy this company or he's going to have to sell his position. He has made an astronomical profit. And people like me that have been short on and off for the last 4 or 5 years have been the losers. There is no ifs, ands, or buts about it. When it comes to the stock price and it comes to being short, I have been wrong. When it comes to the facts about the company and it comes to a lot of the criticisms that I've lodged and points that I've argued, I feel like I've been right about some things. Some people will tell you it doesn't matter if your P&L is terrible. Other people, you know, will tell you it matters more to be right morally and not monetarily. You can take whatever side of that argument you want. You're not going to hurt my feelings. But let's talk about what Icahn's going to do, right? Because now, what are you going to do? You're going to be able to go out and get the equity capital that you need to buy this company with a enterprise value, I think, that's probably somewhere around $9 billion now. So if you use the company's enterprise value, you're paying I think 17 or 18 times free cash flow. I mean, that's a really expensive price for a company whose business model is questionable, in my opinion. It's more, if you look at Kubiko's Twitter feed today, at KEUBIKO, he put up a nice chart of comparables of all the companies that it is valued higher than. And there's a lot of legitimate consumer goods companies on that list. Companies like General Mills and Kellogg's and these legitimate, giant, massive food conglomerates that have been around for 10 trillion years and sell their products in a traditional fashion. They don't use the multi-level marketing business model. You know, so the question is, in my opinion, who's going to come in and take the company private here? What's the long thesis here now? Now that Bill Ackman has announced he's officially out of the race. what's the long thesis? Multiple expansion from, you know, a PE of 20 or 22? Okay. You know, well, the business model's great. Okay, debatable. You know, the bad thing about, you know, shorting multi-level marketing companies is that they spout off a ton of cash, right? So this company still has a relatively impressive free cash flow yield, but it's not increasing. It's not really a growth story. You know, volume points were down year over year, 3.6%. Revenue is stagnating. Cash flow is stagnating. The company stopped disclosing in its filings the amount of total members it had, I think somewhere after right after it went over 4 million, which leads me to believe that that number may have decreased, and that may be the reason that they stopped disclosing it. So what do you own? I mean, you own a company that has a business model that the FTC has said relies on recruiting. That's what the FTC has alleged, right, in their complaint. So what are you going to pay for that? And are you going to be able to find somebody to come in now and take this company out at a premium with the equity priced at $95? You're going to get somebody to come in and pay $11 billion for this company, or $11.5 billion in terms of enterprise value? I don't know. So Carl either has to take it private himself, try to find the equity capital to do some type of buyout. Somebody put on my Seeking Alpha article today, you know, maybe do a reverse takeover. Or he needs to take what has been an exorbitant profit for him, and now with Ackman out of the picture, theoretically an ego victory, a moral victory as well, and find a way out. So if he was going to try and find a way out, how do I think he would do it? I think it would need to be like a three-pronged move. I think he would need to tender some of his shares. I think he would need to arrange a block trade for some of his, I think he has like 20 something million shares, right? So you figure the company is going to tender for, off the top of my head, let's see, I think the tender is 650 million. I don't know off the top of my head, but let's just say the company is going to tender for 7.5 million shares. And I just made that up, but I think it's something like that. So say he tenders 5 million, he arranges a block trade for, you know, 5 or 10 million, and then he might actually be able to unload some on the open market too. He'd have to do it quickly, and he would have to do it, I think, in the span of like 2 days before he disclosed it. But with the stock at 95, he can afford to mow down the bid a little bit if he needs to. And he might be able to just kind of arrange something quickly. And even if he gets stuck, you know, quote unquote bag holding, you know, a million shares, 2 million shares, 3 million shares, or whatever, and he wanted to just blow them out, he could still do that at a relatively substantial profit because he's been extremely successful in the trade. So the question is, what is he going to do from here? And while I'm certainly not saying he's definitely going to do that, I do find it interesting that there was no language like that in the press release this morning. We'll have to look at the SEC filing for the tender offer. Perhaps they will include that language in that document. Or perhaps they won't. But I do know that Icon has a history of tendering in order to tendering or selling into buybacks. Let's just say he has a history of selling into buybacks in order to exit a position. He did it with Motorola Solutions, and he did it with one other company. I can't remember off the top of my head. And, you know, with Netflix, he dumped his position in that company, I think, after they did a 2-for-1 split. So generally, you do a split like that, it's going to increase liquidity a little bit. I mean, I really don't see the strategic move for the company to do a 2-for-1 split here, unless, you know, what they would be trying to do is just to, you know, kind of show people that the stock is quote-unquote cheap from a stock price perspective. People that don't understand valuation, they don't understand market cap, they don't understand valuation multiples. I mean, I guess it'll look cheaper trading $47.50 instead of trading $95. So you may be able to rope in more retail investors. You know, I just don't know. I'm trying to think, like, how many companies do 2-for-1 split with the stock price under $100? I mean, it's definitely a strategy move. The only question is, why do it? Is it to increase the amount of buyers? Is it to create liquidity? It doesn't really matter, to be honest with you. I mean, I look at it as a relatively pointless event, similar to the name change. I mean, you could tell they were going to change their name to Herbalife Nutrition for a while now because that's what they've had on their website. So that move didn't stun me at all. I don't know why they don't announce this stuff when they had just announced earnings a little while ago. So I don't know if there's some strategy there behind the timing or if they're just kind of, you know, they just got the stuff done and now they're doing it now. But, you know, what I do know is, look, John DeSimone is moving out of the chief financial officer role. Michael Johnson has moved out of the chief executive officer role. Okay. Bill Ackman is now out of the picture. And the stock is trading at all-time highs and with a extremely optimistic valuation at a time when the company just posted very poor comps for Q4 and volume points down 3.6% for the year. And so, you know, when I did that podcast or whatever it was with Ivan Feinseth a couple months ago, this is one of the things that we talked about. You know, we talked about are the fundamentals going to improve? Is the underlying business going to improve, or is it just going to be a case for multiple expansion? And so far, the underlying business has not improved, at least from the way that I see it, unless Ivan wants to, you know, come on and talk about it and point out to me that I'm wrong. But the underlying fundamentals don't seem to have improved. So if that's the case, the stock is going up and it's just, you know, the valuation getting more optimistic. I mean, if you think it's the type of company that warrants a more aggressive valuation, then by all means, I would step in and buy it here at $95 a share. But I'm having trouble seeing the long case from here. You know, full disclaimer, I've had trouble seeing the long case basically since, you know, $30 a share. So, you know, I'm not on here trying to be sanctimonious or trying to preach, and I certainly acknowledge that the stock has done the absolute opposite of what I thought it was going to do. I mean, I wrote an article at the beginning of 2017 talking about why I thought the stock would trade down to $35 or $40 a share by the end of the year last year. And so, I mean, to say that I got that wrong is an immense understatement. However, that does not mean that the underlying facts to the thesis are incorrect. It just means that the timing has been wrong and the market has disagreed with me. And that's the cool thing about the market. You know, sometimes you feel like a genius and other times the market will just, you know, furiously pound your head into the pavement or crush your skull like a ping pong ball under a freight locomotive. So we'll have to see going forward from here what the stock is going to do. $100 will probably be the next level that it'll test. You know, I guess a lot of times going into these 2-for-1 splits, companies will go up in price. If you remember, too, the last time that they finished their Dutch tender, the company rose accordingly with basically the valuation of the company adjusts in conjunction with the amount of shares that are taken out of the outstanding share count. And so the stock rose, I don't know if you remember, after the completion of the last Dutch tender. So, you know, it remains to be seen whether or not that'll happen again or whether or not that was priced in today. But certainly Bill Ackman coming out and saying that he's all but gone has led everybody to believe that maybe the short case is really dead now. I happen to think that there are still some risks. And by the way, guys, stop me if I sound pathetic, okay? I know I've been saying the same shit for 4 or 5 years, but I just have a lot of trouble believing in the long-term viability of an investment in this company. You know, if you're going to pay 20 times earnings, what you're assuming is this company is going to be able to earn what it's earning now for the next 20 years. I mean, that just doesn't sound reasonable to me. It doesn't sound like, you know, if you go out and you buy McDonald's today, you're making a bet that at 25 times earnings, McDonald's is going to return to you what it has earned over this past year, at least for the next 25 years. And anything on top of that is going to be an appreciation on your investment, right? So with this business model and with some of the new risks, I just don't know if it's worth paying up for. And some of the new risks include, you know, there is a bribery investigation that's still going on in China. I believe that is in conjunction with the SEC. I'll have to go back and read the filing, so don't quote me on that. There is a new lawsuit that was filed in September of 2017 that, according to a Law 360 article, is now alleging or is now trying to claim $1 billion in damages, which is a material number, far more material than any of the other lawsuits that the company has faced. There is, it was reported, I think, a couple of months ago that Italy and some senators in Italy were starting to look at the business. I don't really know the specifics of that. And then I've just heard a bunch of various rumors and other things, none of which are proof enough to be substantiated to be even mentioned. But just in general, I feel like there's still a fair amount of risk here that the market is not discounting. And I've been saying that for years, and I've been wrong in terms of the stock price, definitely for years. So, you know, I'll offer a congratulations to people that were long the stock without making a comment on the the moral argument over whether or not it is a disingenuous business model or not. I will say that in terms of the stock price and in terms of the investment, I've been wrong. And that people that have gotten long the stock have made money and have been right. Going forward from here, we'll have to see what happens. Like I said, with the Dutch tender auction, we'll see. You know, the other thing too is now they're paying an extraordinary amount to tender these shares. So, I mean, is this like the best use of capital for the company to be tendering for shares at 18 times free cash flow? If you use the enterprise value, something like that. Something like 18 times free cash flow. Is this, you know, is the stock so grossly undervalued that this is what you want to go out and do? You want to go out and buy back stock here? I don't know. I mean, it doesn't seem like a prudent use of capital. They're going to have to refinance this debt, they said today. I don't think the terms of the refi will be especially atrocious, but I do think that they will tighten the screws a little bit as it happens when you go to refi in a probably slightly higher interest rate environment than it was when they took on the debt. So interest expense may creep up a little bit, or they may have to make some other sacrifices there when it comes to the balance sheet. But all in all, you know, I guess the company is just counting on capitalizing this free cash that they continue to bring in. But with the balance sheet the way that it is, and the consent order, according to the company in its last 10K, you know, potentially having a negative effect on profitability going forward and already making an impact, if something interrupts that cash flow stream, if anything kind of gets in the way of that cash flow stream, you may see a repricing of the equity very quickly. And if something like a major seller decides that this is a good-looking price to go out and sell some shares, and some of the float loosens up a little bit, because the float is very tight right now, you can point to most of the outstanding shares. And that happens, you know, you may start to see a little bit more in the way of price discovery. So from there, we'll have to see what happens. But I encourage you to check out my Seeking Alpha article that I wrote early this morning about Icon and the Dutch tender, and get my thoughts on that. I really don't have time to go into Fitbit earnings for the most part, but for the fact that, you know, the numbers were atrocious, and yes, there is a GoPro style argument to the company, and yes, the product is semi-commoditized, and yes, you can get smartwatches everywhere. But if you read my initial notes on the company, you know, part of the reason that I was pitched on the company as a long, because it wasn't my idea, it was brought to me by another investor who I'm not going to mention their name because I don't know if they want to be known, but they brought it to my attention. You know, part of that argument was that they had a good patent portfolio and that they were going to transition to a software company and that they were moving to monetize a lot of their data. They were working with United Health, the insurance company. Everybody kind of knew that the numbers weren't going to be fantastic, but nobody expected them to be this bad, especially after Fossil posted their great quarter. So the stock popped, I think, from like 520 to 550 after Fossil reported. People are figuring watch company does good, another watch company could do good, and it was just the opposite. Fossil did great, and Fitbit did atrocious. So I have some new notes in my email inbox right now from that same buddy, I might review them and do a separate podcast on it, but for now, at least wanted to give some quick thoughts about Powell's congressional testimony yesterday and how I think everything is doomed, and what I thought of the little Herbalife fiasco today. So I will try to update as new facts become available. I don't want to make my podcast an Herbalife exclusive only thing, but just so happens we've had some news here over the last 2 weeks. I have some great guests lined up. I have three people confirmed that are going to come on whose names I won't mention, but you will probably know them. Just working on scheduling and getting them in to call in and do the podcast. And I'm really excited about it. The podcast has done really well since I've started putting it up. And, you know, to the people that listen, I'm extraordinarily gracious. And it's been some really nice positive reinforcement for me. And, you know, I can't thank you guys enough. It's so cool that you guys are interested. A lot of times when you have a different perspective and a different take on things, it's easy to feel like you're very much in the minority. And so when I speak to people that are like-minded, whether it's people that leave me comments on the podcast or people that will leave me notes on Twitter or write me emails, it's a really nice feeling. And so, you know, I really appreciate you guys, and I appreciate learning from all of you. And hopefully you can learn some stuff from me as well. But more importantly, hopefully we can have a laugh. And like I said, hopefully you adhere to the 2-drink minimum on this podcast. Because in real life, if you wanted to talk about all this shit, I would make you drag my ass to a bar and buy me a beer and a shot. And so if we can't do that in real life, we can do it here over the podcast. Hope everybody has a good one, and you can expect to hear from me over the next couple of days. Peace!